64 in Boston.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. When the American bombing campaign began on October 7th, everyone from the pundits to the Pentagon warned the public that this was going to take a while. But just 2 months later, it looks like Taliban leaders might be sleeping, if they can, through their last night in power. Tomorrow, the surrender is likely to begin and the era of the Taliban to end. Earlier today, I spoke with Peter Grest of the BBC about the surrender of Kandahar, which is expected to begin tomorrow. I asked him what the situation in Kandahar was at day's end.
What we understand is that a ceasefire has been declared around the city to allow negotiations about the finer points of this deal to carry on. The Taliban are inside Kandahar and still in control of the city. The anti-Taliban factions are moving into place around Kandahar, but as I say, at this stage, everything seems reasonably quiet.
So are people there expecting a surrender tomorrow, Friday, in Kandahar?
I think that's the expectation. It's too early still to say whether it will in fact happen, as we believe. Deals have been made and broken in Afghanistan too many times before for anybody to say that it's certainly the end game. But clearly, I think that the Taliban have recognized the reality and the fact that they can no longer hold on to the city.
Do you have a sense of the volume of opposition forces that are massed around Kandahar, or is it really the U.S. bombing that's bringing this surrender?
I think it's been a combination of factors. The Americans have certainly kept up the pressure on the Taliban and really smashed their defenses, smashed their bases, smashed their supply lines to the point where they've become unusable. But also the ground forces that have been working against the Taliban have equally been applying a tremendous amount of pressure. They've been cutting off the escape routes on the ground and making sure that the Taliban are really hampered, that they simply they're not able to fight. And I think the two-pronged approach, as it were, has both been equally responsible for bringing about this latest deal.
The word earlier today out of Afghanistan was that Hamid Karzai, who's been named to head the new interim government in Afghanistan, had got the surrender from the Taliban on the basis of a promise of amnesty for the Taliban leader, Mullah Muhammad Omar. Washington has made ambiguous sounds on that, but doesn't appear too keen on it. If Mullah Omar is not given amnesty, might the surrender fall apart?
It could well fall apart, although I suspect that this whole thing has gone too far for them, for the Taliban to back out now. The BBC has in fact been speaking to Ahmed Karzai, and he told us that he's broken the deal on the assumption that, or on the basis that Mullah Omar can get amnesty, provided he renounces terrorism, provided he cooperates and hands over any foreign fighters to an international tribunal for trial. Clearly, that's something that is unacceptable as far as the Pentagon and as far as Washington is concerned. Washington desperately wants to see Mullah Omar go on trial and be called to account for his involvement with the al-Qaeda network.
It could be difficult. Hamid Karzai said his life will be saved. He will be allowed to live with dignity. He is not guilty.
That's right. This is going to cause a great deal of friction, I suspect, between Ahmed Karzai and the Americans. Mr. Karzai has broken what he said is an Afghan deal. He said he didn't consult Washington on the detail of this, certainly didn't talk to Washington about the amnesty deal. But equally, this is very much, as I said, an Afghan thing. This is something that we've seen time and again. In fact, just earlier today, I was out talking to some people in a restaurant and discovered two men, one who was a former Taliban commander, eating lunch with his colleague, who was a man that he'd actually captured from the Northern Alliance. These two men were now firm friends to the point where they were sharing a meal. It's not unusual in Afghan circumstances. It's not unusual in Afghan terms for these sorts of bizarre swaps to take place. It's very much a case of business as usual.
What about the prospects for lesser Taliban officials and Taliban troops?
They will probably go back to their farms, they'll go back to their homes, they will probably join other militias, they'll probably swap sides a couple of times. This is all part of the shakedown of the Afghan military scene. It's not unusual, as I say. We've seen this right across the country throughout this whole conflict, where Taliban fighters have swapped sides and joined forces with the Northern Alliance and with other anti-Taliban factions. They will be given amnesty. They will be treated reasonably well until they can find a new place inside the Afghan military landscape.
What about non-Afghan fighters? In each city that surrendered, we seem to have found a knot or more than a knot of these. What are the prospects for them?
quite different, I'm afraid. Those people will probably not receive a great deal of sympathy. The kind of goodwill that's extended to former fighters in Afghanistan really is only limited to other Afghans. They don't have a great deal of patience or sympathy for foreigners who come in and fight inside Afghanistan. The deal that's been broken very clearly states that those foreign fighters will be handed over to an international tribunal. The Americans will almost certainly want to be involved with that. They'll certainly want to interview any al-Qaeda members, and I don't think that they'll receive a great deal of sympathy.
So, Peter, if the surrender goes through tomorrow, as expected, how will you then describe the situation in Afghanistan? Is the war over at that point?
Certainly the conflict for the time being is over, but we're already seeing military frictions, or we're seeing political frictions, rather, develop between a number of members of the Northern Alliance, a number of factions within the alliance. These are factions who aren't particularly happy with the kind of political arrangement that was reached in Germany. They say that the separation, or the distribution, rather, of cabinet seats was unfair. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to go back to war, but the factions that are disputing this are very, very powerful indeed. One of them is General Dostum, who controls a very large army up in the north of the country, and he's frequently in the past gone against the government, gone against Kabul, and fought against the administration here. So, although, as I say, it's still way too early to suggest that we're anywhere near a resumption of fighting between the rival factions, I also think it's equally too early to say that Afghanistan is out of the woods just yet.
Finally, Peter, Kandahar was the Taliban's birthplace and stronghold. Do you expect scenes like Kabul's celebration there, or might it be different?
That's a very, very difficult question to answer. There isn't a great deal of sympathy. In fact, there's quite a deal of antagonism towards the United States for the bombardment that it rained down on Kandahar. I think most people in Kandahar will be simply glad to see this whole mess over with. I don't know that they'll be overjoyed to see the new people come in, the new forces come into Kandahar, but I'm certain that they will be very, very pleased indeed to see the end of the siege, to see the end of the bombardment, and to see a point where they can now get back to something approaching an ordinary life.
Peter Grest of the BBC. He spoke to me earlier from Kabul. All eyes will be on Kandahar tomorrow when the Taliban, if all goes according to plan, is set to relinquish power. Is this the end of the Taliban in Afghanistan? What happens to Mullah Muhammad Omar and the other Taliban stalwarts? Is the interim government established just yesterday ready to take control? And what does it all mean for the American mission in Afghanistan and the hunt for Osama bin Laden? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. We're joined tonight by Richard Bullitt. He's a professor of history at Columbia University who knows Afghanistan well. Good evening, Professor Richard Bullitt.
Good evening, Tom.
Good to have you with us. And we're also joined happily in studio tonight by our own news analyst, Jack Beattie, down from the Northlands. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Good to see you. Richard Bullitt, and I have to start off by correcting something. In my conversation with Peter Grest, I attributed to Hamid Karzai the comment that Mullah Omar, his life will be saved, that he is not guilty. That actually came today from Mullah Abdul Salam Zaif, who we knew well a few weeks ago as Taliban's envoy to Pakistan. But clearly, there is a kind of a divergent view today between the negotiations around Kandahar and what's coming out of Washington about what will happen with the senior members of the Taliban regime if and when they surrender tomorrow. How does that all look to you? How important is that?
I think it's important, but I don't think that the statements in Washington are being entirely candid. I think the important thing is not the idea, though, that Mullah Muhammad Omar would be put on trial, but rather that he come into American custody at least for a period of time so that he can be interrogated to find out what he knows about everything about al-Qaeda, because he has been a close associate of bin Laden, but not actually a member of al-Qaeda for a long time. This goes beyond simply finding out where bin Laden may be. The possibility that Mullah Muhammad Omar may have operational information or know of personnel in other countries has to be explored. If he simply is amnestied and allowed to go into a quiet retirement in Kandahar, and the American interrogators don't have a crack at him, then we lose a very important asset.
What a fascinating dynamic here. I mean, that's just one element of it. So you're saying, first of all, the United States wants to interrogate Mullah Muhammad Omar. I'm not sure if I'd want to be a fly in that room or not, and how much to expect him to give up. So we take that point. But then there's the issue of what to do with him. Does the United States, first of all, want to be the agency of justice here, or would they prefer to have some kind of rough justice executed by the Northern Alliance or others? Can they even conceive of the option of amnesty to a man who's spoken with such vitriol toward Washington?
Yeah, I don't think that. I think that when the U.S. talks about putting him on trial, et cetera, that is a threat that will be used to try and extract from him whatever he can tell them. No one has accused Mohammed Omar directly of attacking the United States, and in fact, the Taliban forces really have not, taken any American lives in Afghanistan, as far as we know. And I think that this is more a threat,
amazingly,
more of a threat than a. Than a clear intent.
So you're suggesting then, implicit in that, is that if he would speak, then in fact he might have access to this life of amnesty and exile.
I think that his efforts in Afghanistan from the very beginning were centered on the idea of bringing peace to Afghanistan. The fact that he had a particularly intolerant and from our point of view, barbaric interpretation of Islam perhaps mattered less to the Afghans than the fact that the areas that the Taliban took over did not have fighting for a period of years. So he has actually contributed something to Afghanistan, even though the nature of his rule was extremely onerous.
Jack Beatty, I stand by Professor Bullitt, but Jack Beatty, I wonder if this is a more benign view of Mohammed Omar than the White House has. Ari Fleischer was saying just today that President Bush, quote, believes very strongly that those who harbor terrorists need to be brought to justice. Now, Richard Bullitt saying maybe this is just to scare to scare
yes.
Mohammed Omar. Let's leave it
the
at that.
can you
imagine Washington letting him go into exile?
No, I can't. It does seem. On the other hand, I wonder what the professor thinks about this. But it sounds to me as if that the convergent interest we had with the opposition forces through the war, now we're having more divergent interests. I mean, their first interest, certainly the Pashtun leader Karzai, is reconciliation and reconstruction and to build a government. And this is obviously going to require some overture to elements of the Taliban. They're part of the population. They're part, many of them, of his ethnic tribal group. And our interests, of course, are justice. So I think we're in a kind of period of tension here that in the peace, if that's what it is, that we didn't really have in the war.
How about that, Richard Bullitt?
Well, I think that what we really want is to get Mullah Mohammed into our custody and then see what we will do with him. But I agree entirely with Jack that this is a period now when the Afghans are going to try and make peace. I think it's very important that the person who is receiving the surrender in Kandahar is a fellow Pashtun, that he is not someone from the north. It also means that a Pashtun force that has a major role in the interim government is going to be holding a major city while the Northern Alliance holds Kabul. So there's a kind of balancing thing there.
A balance, but also a division of power that could cut the other way.
Yep. And therefore, Hamid Karzai is going to want some of those Taliban fighters to feel sympathetic toward him if things begin to go south.
Oh, Jack, do you hear that? This is not just in order to cut the deal, but in fact, maybe Richard Bullitt's suggesting to have troops in his back pocket.
Yeah, that is interesting. You know, the plan in Bonn is that the peacekeepers, UN peacekeepers, or international peacekeepers in Kabul, are there to protect the Pashtun. Isn't that right, Professor?
Well, yes, because the population in Kabul is fearful of them. But remember, you also have a concern on the part of the Pakistanis not to have the Northern Alliance be too strong.
Richard Bullitt, hold the thought. You're opening our eyes. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking about what appears to be the imminent surrender of Kandahar, and with it, the demise of the Taliban. Is this the end for the Taliban? Do you believe it? And how do you feel about that? Proud? Safer? Hopeful? Or something else? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with Professor Richard Bullitt of Columbia University and our own news analyst Jack Beatty about the apparently imminent surrender in Kandahar, the apparently imminent end of the Taliban, and what all that will mean. Richard Bullitt, I'm sorry we had to interrupt you, but you were just going to the point of the division of power post-surrender and how that will all look to Washington.
Well, how it looks to Washington is important, but how it looks to Pakistan as well. Mm. When you talked about with the BBC correspondent about the foreign soldiers there, I think you have to make a distinction between Arab foreigners who are working for bin Laden and Pakistani fellow tribesmen, Pakhtuns, who have come across to join the Taliban. Mm-hmm. My guess is that they're simply going to be allowed to go home and that this will be satisfying to the Pakistanis. I think the Pakistanis will like the idea of a Pashtun force taking over in Kandahar and the Taliban being conciliated.
Hope is not all lost in that case, and we have begun to make the distinction on this program in the last few nights between the Pashtuns who just drifted in across the border to help their brother Pashtuns and others. What about that? Let's go down. So we've decided perhaps Mohammed Omar will be allowed to go into some kind of exile if he coughs up what the United States want. We'll wait and see. I fear there may still be a violent end for him somewhere. But what about the other high leadership of the Taliban? What about Taliban troops rank and file? You're suggesting that the Hamid Karzai may just want to recruit them right into his army. Is it as simple as that?
In Afghan history over the last 20 years, that happens all the time.
Wow. Imagine.
rolling over the surrendered troops and giving them a new uniform is not uncommon.
So yesterday there were Taliban, and tomorrow they're the soldiers of the new interim president or the leader of the interim government of Afghanistan, ally of the United States.
And they're helping to make weight for a Pashtun force in the balance of power that is coming along with that interim government. And, of course, we want that interim government to take its time getting in place so that we can finish our business before we have to deal with it as a really as a formal government.
Well, this is really what it comes to, isn't it? I mean, on the one hand, you ask yourself, can the United States live with an Afghan peace, all this horse trading and swapping of uniforms? On the other hand, it really comes down to what our interests are there. After the surrender in Kandahar, Richard Bullitt, how do you see the American interest? What is number one, two, and three on the agenda?
Number one is to do what we can to make the interim government work and make sure that the Loya Jirga that is scheduled for 6 months after that actually comes about and sets up a government. Number two is to create a strong impression in the world that we are healing Afghanistan. For the Muslim population of the world that has heard now for ever since October 7th when the bombing started, that we are killing Afghans, invading, hurting Muslims, for us to turn around and be good guys there and have it be known and have it be real instead of just symbolic, that's a very important step for us.
Mm-hmm. And third, if you've got a third on that agenda, it must be Osama bin Laden.
I guess third is finishing off Osama bin Laden, certainly, but also to take care of our situation with the neighboring countries of Afghanistan, because we're not the only ones who have to live with this government. The Iranians do, the Uzbeks do, the Pakistanis do, and we're going to have to help that along.
Richard Bullitt, Jack Beatty, stand by. We've got another guest I want to bring on. Anwar Ahadi is with us. He's a professor of political science at Providence College in Rhode Island, and he was one of the 30-odd delegates to the UN talks on Afghanistan in Bonn, Germany, that just concluded this week. Welcome, Anwar Ahadi. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Obviously, a key piece of what's going to be unfolded in the next few days is the viability of this interim government. There was clearly an immense amount of pressure brought on the Afghan delegates in Bonn, where you were, to bring off an agreement. We understand that you were actually invited into this government and declined a position and, in fact, declined to sign the agreement. Why did you decline, and what kind of tension does that represent?
Well, actually, actually, the agreement is okay with me. I would have not been. It would have not been. I would have been willing to sign the agreement itself. It's just that I did not like the composition of the cabinet. I thought it was quite unfair that the Northern Alliance almost got 65% to 70% of the seats, and they were treated very differently than the other groups. So I do not like that part. And I asked the question whether signing on the agreement, does this mean also endorsing the annex regarding the composition of the cabinet? And they said yes, so therefore I refused to sign that.
But precisely that kind of reservation can lead to all sorts of mayhem if others share it. That's the division of spoils and division of power that could lie at the heart of a real problem with this interim government, could it not?
Yes, it could, but I should say that the agreement itself and this very process, the idea itself, it has strong international backing, and I think the international backing would enable to ensure success of the agreement that has been reached here.
So despite the imbalances that you're concerned about, you're expecting that this interim government will survive, will work.
I think so. I think it will survive, and it will work. It's just that personally I was quite unhappy with it, and I indicated my unhappiness regarding the composition. I don't think it will have much consequences.
Of course, though, you're not the only one who's already expressing unhappiness. Jack Beatty, you've been following some of the other dissent around Afghanistan even today.
Yes. Reuters reports that General Dostan, who's the warlord around Maraz Sharif, is saying, I'm going to boycott this new government. It doesn't have enough Uzbek representatives. And I gather that Professor Ahadi is objecting that the Pushtun aren't getting enough representatives. And I see in today's Times that there's another Pushtun, Abdul Rab Rasul Saif, who also is unhappy with this settlement and who has been, according to the Times, organizing. Now, what any significance to that, Professor Ahadi? Are you involved in that?
Not really, no. I don't think there is that much significance to this. And even if Dostum and Ismail Khan and all the others, if they oppose it, the idea here is to establish a relatively strong government in Kabul. The focus is on Kabul. Once you have a central government that is stable in Kabul, it will gradually spread its authority to the rest of the country. So even if Dostum disagrees in the north or Ismail Khan or someone else disagrees in the west, it shouldn't really matter. As long as this package that is aimed at establishing a government in Kabul is that is established and there is strong international support behind it and there is money for reconstruction, I think the other centers of power will gradually weaken and the central government will enhance its authority.
Anwar Ahadi, step way back with us for a second. Give us the big view. We don't want to lose the forest for the trees. An unbelievable turn of events has taken place in the last 2 months. Are you happy with what's happened? Are you more hopeful now than you were 2 months ago about Afghanistan's future? Has this huge intervention been a success in your eyes?
Well, I'm happy that Taliban are gone. I'm unhappy that the government, that the country is returning back to what it was between 1992 and 96. The same warlords that ruled Afghanistan and divided Afghanistan between themselves between 92 and 96, the same thing is happening again. I mean, Ismail Khan is in the west, Dostum is in the north, the Hazaras, Khalilis are in central Afghanistan, and the Qadir and the others there in eastern Afghanistan, and maybe another power will emerge in the south too. And we warned the State Department and the Americans about the possibility of this happening. If we did not have in advance some sort of a political arrangement, some sort of political agreement, and if they attack Afghanistan, what will happen is that there would be there would be vacuum and it will lead to political chaos. Well, this is what it has happened. But I think what happened in Bonn is that it provides for the establishment of a relatively strong government in Kabul that I think eventually will overcome these disintegrating tendencies. But it will take a while. But as long as there is international support for it, I think eventually will prevail.
I take that as a net positive. It sounds like a pretty overall warm assessment of what's happened. Anwar Ahadi, thank you very much for joining us for a few minutes tonight.
Thank you.
Richard Bullitt, you heard Anwar Ahadi's assessment. He was in Bonn with the Afghan delegation. He declined to join the cabinet himself, but he's saying if international support is strong, this can work. Do you think that international support will be there? And now that this kind of Wild West period ends, who can knock heads if some of the players in Afghanistan begin to get out of line.
Yeah, I think that he's right that there is a good chance that this will work. International support, of course, is very largely financial, possibly having a Muslim security force occupying, checkpoints around Kabul or something of that sort. But push will come to shove when you get the question of disarming militias. And there it may be that international pressure will have to be exerted of other sorts. For example, General Dostum is an Uzbek. It may be the President Karimov of Uzbekistan is going to have to lean on him and say, that he has to accede to this. It may be that the Iranians and the Pakistanis will have roles to play with their respective client groups. And if they think that the government has a chance of making it, they may well simply do that and help make it work.
Richard Bullitt, stand by. We've got callers who want to join the conversation. We're talking tonight about the apparently imminent surrender of Kandahar and, with it, effectively the end of the Taliban. Did you ever think they would fold so quickly? Does the end of the Taliban feel like victory to you or just a step in the long, unusual war that President Bush describes? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Michael is on the line. Welcome, Michael. You're on the air.
Hello. This isn't really surprising. After World War II, initially, we were willing to put any number of Nazis and industrialist collaborators with them and Japanese fascists in jail and hang a couple of them. But when the Cold War supervened, they were our friends and we worked with them. And we were happy to have them on our side. I don't think America is worse than other nations in this. In fact, we at least go through periods in which we're better at it. But when it comes down to it, we're interested in our interests, and any sort of morality is often just a fig leaf.
Well, quite right. And it's an interesting point, Michael. Jack Biddy, let me put it to you. I mean, wars are intended to bring resolutions, but they don't bring heaven on earth. And Michael's quite right that we worked with plenty of Japanese and Germans who were quite prominent in those enemy armies during World War II.
That's certainly true. I think the American tradition, we've sort of got into a bad habit with our wars. Many of them have been unconditional surrenders where, to the victor belongs everything. I mean, Japan is, we reinvent Japan and so on. But that's not on here. And it sounds as if the Afghans, after years of this, have worked out a kind of wisdom of fighting. You fight today and then you join with people tomorrow and success has a certain momentum. Perhaps we can learn from them that wars don't have to be these ultimate last ditch to the last man, unconditional surrender affairs.
Though the Afghan formula has not always worked in the past.
No.
And Lord knows how that will work this time. Michael, thanks for your call. We're joined now by Ambassador Robert Hunter. He's a senior advisor at RAND and former U.S. Ambassador to NATO. Good evening, Ambassador Hunter.
Good evening to you.
Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Help us look now at the forward U.S. commitment to Afghanistan right across the board in terms of development and in military terms. What are we going to have to pour in there, and when will we be able to take our military out?
Well, the first thing is the war, as it's been defined by the president and I think by the nation, isn't over. There were three parts. The third part was to remove the Taliban from power because of their role in harboring terrorists. The second part was collapsing the al-Qaeda networks in that country and getting their fighters. And the first part was getting Osama al-Baden, bin Laden. And those two parts we haven't done, and therefore the U.S. military, supported by the British and others that we may or may not take along, have to continue that until that is completed.
Well, pull that apart for us. We know we don't have Osama bin Laden yet. We have some sense that al-Qaeda has been hit if the characterizations of, very early on we were destroying camps. As we marched through the different cities, or the Northern Alliance did, we heard that al-Qaeda troops were being disarmed, destroyed, killed. How much of the dismantling of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan do you think has already occurred? How much remains?
No way of telling at this great distance, but at some point, both the United States government and credible other observers are going to give us an indication of that. Then that leaves us with the most important thing, which is how do you get Osama bin Laden? And if it turns out he's fled the country or been killed, that's one thing. But if he's still on the loose, then the United States will have to continue doing what it's doing by what appropriate methods, the military find that it's likely to achieve it.
How do you think that's likely to play out? Might we put more troops into Afghanistan now that a presumably a friendly government will soon be fully in power to go after bin Laden? How much patience will we have at the force level that we're at? Are we willing to have all this hardware assembled and these troops assembled for month after month looking for him? Or would we try and turn it over to a smaller police force at some point? Give us some sense of how this might transpire.
Well, I think there's no way of telling precisely that because one doesn't know where he is or what the techniques are being used to try to find him. But I think it is clear that the United States will need to persevere in doing that until they either get him or have credible evidence that he's either dead or he's gone to another country. That is, after all, the reason the United States went in there. And I think you've already seen the patience of the American people has been really quite extraordinary in this, and I think people will be willing to wait until the job is done, always remembering the horrendous quality of what this man instigated on September 11.
Can you imagine more troops going in now to supplement the 1,000 Marines that are there?
Oh, I think it's a matter of the military will determine what is needed. If you don't have combat on the ground, as we've seen now in going against the Taliban, one would suspect that you wouldn't need more regular forces, maybe no regular forces at all, just special forces, or maybe most of it will be done from the air. But no outsider can really determine that. That's really something the military is going to have to use its best judgment to achieve the particular goal.
And Robert Hunter, we know it's not all over yet, and certainly the Taliban could turn around and refute its agreement and fight to a bloody end. But given all that's unfolded in the last 2 months in Afghanistan, how do you feel about what the U.S. and its allies have accomplished there this fall in this rather surprisingly short time?
Well, I think it's quite remarkable. You've had, beginning with the Northern Alliance and then with others, who've shown a good deal of will to fight and to get rid of the Taliban. In some ways, from their perspective, in terms of what they've done, it just shows how disgusted most people in that country became with this particular regime. On top of that, the application of force from outside, mostly American, some British, has been very intelligently done. There could have been pressure at the beginning to just flail out and kill a lot of civilians, and I think that's what Osama was trying to get us to do.
Mm-hmm.
The United States took its time, created the intelligence it needed, worked with the locals, and then applied force in a way that that wrapped it up. And I don't know anybody who thought it was going to go this fast. And that has to be gratifying, but it's something more. Part of the objective after September 11, with what has been done by al-Qaeda and by Osama, and by the Taliban, who are giving them support. And
Robert Hunter, hold that thought. We're going to have to take it after a short break.
I'm
sorry. We're talking about the imminent surrender of Kandahar. Does it look like the end of the first phase of this battle to you? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, or get into the conversation online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the apparently imminent surrender of Kandahar and, with it, the end of the Taliban. Ambassador Robert Hunter, we had to cut you off for the break, and I'm sorry for that, but you were just winding up for your big conclusion, and we want to hear it.
Let me put it very simply. Part of what's been going on here is a demonstration by the United States that if someone does this kind of thing, they're going to pay a price for it.
Mm-hmm.
This was a real United Nations of slaughter. There were about 60 nationalities who died on September 11 in these attacks. The credibility of the United States, the trust other countries have in us, required us to go after not just the perpetrators, but the people who harbored them. This means a lot of other people out there who've been thinking about taking a crack at us or a crack at somebody else is going to think twice about it if they know that they're going to pay a penalty. It's like deterrence of crime. You're more likely to deter crime if somebody thinks he's going to get caught than if he gets caught, he's going to pay a certain kind of penalty. Well, these guys got caught, and the next group is going to think twice.
Robert Hunter, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Ambassador Robert Hunter is a senior advisor at RAND. He's a former U.S. ambassador to NATO. Professor Richard Bullitt, you and other guests tonight have talked about the importance of going after Osama bin Laden and the idea that there's a window of time between the surrender of the Taliban and the formal taking of power by the interim government, where it's still kind of a Wild West and the U.S. can do what it pleases. How long will that window last and how important is that?
Well, the interim government is supposed to take power on December 22nd.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it is important for our public relations image that the interim government not appear to be simply a puppet of the United States, and that when it takes power, that we deal with it as a sovereign government, although on an interim basis. So I think we will probably make a maximum effort to try and achieve our remaining goals before December 22nd.
Mm-hmm.
After all, if we were to say we're going to leave, 1,000 Marines around Jalalabad or someplace indefinitely until we capture bin Laden and everyone who ever worked for him, that would begin to wear out our welcome with this interim government. They want to convince the Afghans that they are actually going to govern Afghanistan and not be there simply as a policeman for the Americans.
This is not Soviet puppetry redux.
That's right.
Hmm. We've got callers who want to join. Let's turn to the phones. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Renato is on the line. Welcome, Renato.
Thanks for listening.
Sure.
About your comments on the issue over there, I'm still very concerned about that because for sure the Taliban, they knew the power the U.S. has.
Mm-hmm.
What they did was trying to catch the attention of the world to what's going on in the Middle East. And I think they knew it was about time. It was a question of time for U.S. going in there and dismember them. But wouldn't they have time to regroup somewhere else if the war ends right now, like they did before?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for how long have we been dealing with terrorism?
Mm-hmm.
We have to face the question like the Middle Eastern issue in a different way. I think if we only could dream about bringing the boys back home, taking the guns down, sending the politicians of the world to that part of the world,
mm-hmm.
and tell, don't go back to your countries till you find a peaceful solution
mm-hmm.
for the situation over there. Because there are people dying, innocent children dying everywhere. And,
We hear you, Renato, and it's a point that we can never forget. Thank you for your call. And what about it, Richard Bullitt? Renato makes the point that, yes, we've accomplished something, but maybe it was only a matter of time before the might of the only superpower brought down the little Taliban. But does that really solve the problem in Afghanistan or the region?
Well, I think, Eric, I sympathize with what he was saying about how in the long run we have to look toward peaceful means. But two things. First, the idea of regrouping and
mm-hmm.
continuing to cause trouble.
Reasonable or not? Likely?
The remnants of the Taliban have no friends. And for them to regroup, how do they resupply? How do they manage that? It's very difficult to do. Second point.
But just on that point, they grew almost perhaps not quite organically out of the Muslim schools, the madrasas of Pakistan a decade ago or less. Could that not happen again?
But Tom, the weapons came from 10 years of American supplies coming in there to fight the Soviet Union, plus the Soviet supplies on the other side.
Well, those weapons are not evaporating.
They're not evaporating, but they're not being replaced either. And I think that a government that starts to confiscate weapons and to put them in the hands of a formal army is going to very rapidly reduce the capacity of groups to engage in guerrilla warfare.
So you don't see the Taliban coming back. We take your point there.
Okay. And the second point is that bin Laden has told the Muslim world that the United States is weak, that the United States will not fight, that the United States runs away, that the United States
doesn't have the nerve.
Is cowardly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the Taliban, who are a fairly provincial bunch of guys, they don't know much about the world. They don't know much about the United States. They may have believed that that their record against the Russians, the fact that they were a landlocked country, hard to get to, they may have believed that we could not attack them.
Hey, we almost believed it not so very long ago. There was a lot of talk right around tables in the United States that no one had ever beaten the Afghans.
Right, and that's why I think Ambassador Hunter's point is extremely is extremely pertinent. You know, this has demonstrated that, you know, the fact that you're living in the back beyond somewhere in southern Yemen or Somalia or the jungles of the Philippines or something isn't going to protect you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no place too far away. Richard Bullitt, you've opened our eyes tonight, and we thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Richard Bullitt is professor of history at Columbia University. Well, there you are, Jack. We've got, and it all has yet to actually happen. They have not come out of the stronghold in Kandahar. It's all talk still about surrender, but it seems imminent. And here's the voice that says, well, we proved what we had to prove.
Yes.
You feeling good about it?
Well, we vindicated deterrence, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. I mean, what we were saying when the terrorists struck was that there was no deterrence for terrorism because the threat of death wouldn't deter them. But the nations that harbor terrorists, that's different. They have something to lose, and the Taliban have just lost it.
This conversation will go on online. You can join it at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums to continue the conversation on the imminent surrender. Since September 11th, the New Republic magazine has been keeping track of what it considers to be the most outlandish and ridiculous statements made by public figures since the attacks on the United States. Our special coverage news analyst Jack Beattie caught up with the editor of the magazine about the Idiocy Watch, the column that catalogs and ranks these statements. So Jack, what did they have to say?
Well, I spoke with Peter Beinart there, the editor of the New Republic, about the Idiocy Watch. This is a box they've been running in the magazine since September 11th. And they had a poll of their readers about the most outrageous statements given, I think 7,000 responses. And in Letterman-like fashion, they began with number 9. Let me read you number 9. It is a clinical effusion from Director Oliver Stone. On October 10, he said, and I quote, six men are deciding what you're seeing in film, and they own all the small companies. Mm-hmm. Now, within reason, they let filmmakers do certain things, and that is far better, obviously, than, say, the Arabs, where they don't let you do anything. But we are in a dilemma. We have too much order. And I think the revolt on September 11 was about order. It was about blank you order, blank your order. And is it time, perhaps, to reconsider the world order? Is it time to wonder why the banks have joined the movie companies and all the corporations and where this is all going? That's Oliver Stone. And here's what Peter Beinart of the New Republic had to say about this selection from the Idiocy Watch.
Yeah, I would put that within one category of idiocy that you have seen post-September 11th, which is the idiocy of narcissism. If you can read through the lines here, what he's essentially saying here is he's equating his situation battling the big movie studios in Hollywood to Al-Qaeda battling the world order. Now, that analogy, needless to say, is not a very flattering one to him, but beyond the fact that it's morally kind of monstrous, it's also extraordinarily narcissistic. And so, again, the whole idea behind it is to look at the kind of at fundamental misperceptions of September 11th with the idea that that event is, in some sense, a Rorschach test, which exposes certain problems in our society, and narcissism is one of them.
Rampant. Here's one that is somewhat discrepant with the others in that it is from somebody who's sort of supporting the war. This is Representative John Cooksey of Louisiana, and he made this statement just a week after the attack. He says, if I see someone come in that's got a diaper on his head and a fan belt wrapped around it, that guy needs to be pulled over and checked. Again, that's Representative John Cooksey, a Republican of Louisiana.
Yes, and certainly for us, there's been plenty of idiocy from the right since September 11th as well, not simply from the left. Ann Coulter, who's a prominent conservative commentator, said that we should invade the Muslim countries and convert them to Christianity. I think the only reason we didn't put that one on is that it got so much attention that it was a bit overexposed. But it was a lunatic, needless to say, deeply offensive idea, as, of course, was Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson's notions about us bringing this upon ourselves because we have abortion as legal. And Cook, there's also has been reported a comment by the Republican challenger in the Senate race in Georgia, making a comment about we need to keep Muslims from coming across the state lines. Well, I think President Bush has been pretty good about trying to head this off, and the fact that he's a Republican president, I think in some ways, has meant that he has headed it off more within the Republican Party. But the truth is there is still a bigoted know-nothing streak in American politics, I think particularly on the right, and here it came out.
Indeed, indeed. This is from Alice Walker. This was in The Village Voice, the October 9 issue. In a war on Afghanistan, Alice Walker says, Osama bin Laden will either be left alive while thousands of impoverished, frightened people are bombed into oblivion around him, or he will be killed in a bombing attack for which he seems quite prepared. But what would happen to his cool armor if he could be reminded of all the good, nonviolent things he has done? Further, what would happen to him if he could be brought to understand the preciousness of the lives he has destroyed? I firmly believe the only punishment that works is love. Again, that's Alice Walker.
Replace the word Osama bin Laden with Adolf Hitler, knowing our experience during World War II, and say the only punishment that would have worked against Adolf Hitler was love. Certainly none of us want to be anti-love, but it's a simply nonsensical idea. What exactly are all the good nonviolent things that Osama bin Laden has done, and how could you possibly convince a man who's made it his life's work to foster destruction amongst non-Muslims? How could you possibly make him understand the preciousness of the lives he has destroyed? And what message would that send to other Osama bin Laden?
Right.
That the American response to the killing of thousands of
therapy.
Our citizens will be to come on our knees and say,
yeah,
we really still believe you're a nice person? It's unspeakably naive. People on the left were perfectly willing to understand when Nelson Mandela said in South Africa, nonviolence won't work here because of the nature of the foe we're facing. Why is it that in this circumstance, it seems to me it is at least as clear, they can't understand what the Northern Alliance, in fact, has understood, which is that there's no possible chance that nonviolence could work against the Taliban and Osama bin Laden.
Yeah. This is Michael Moore on his September 12th on his website, but he also gave a version of this, in fact, said these words as a commentary on our program, Special Coverage. Many families have been devastated tonight. This just is not right. They did not deserve to die. If someone did this to get back at Bush, then they did so by killing thousands of people who did not vote for him. Boston, New York, D.C., and the plains destination of California, these were places that voted against Bush.
It really speaks for itself, but...
Did he make this? Was this satire, do you think?
Well, if it was satire, it doesn't seem to me that there's any wit to this at all, nor in any way does it do what I imagine satire is supposed to make you do, which is look in a new and
right,
provocative way at society. All this suggests is perhaps that Republican life is worth less than Democratic life, and that our hatred of George W. Bush should be greater than our hatred of Osama bin Laden. And those seem to me to be two notions post-September 11th, which are absurd and monstrous. Of course there is a role for provocative comment in this society, and of course no one would ever want to silence anyone and deny anyone's right to free speech, but surely people also must take responsibility for what they say, and if someone says something that is absolutely idiotic, not to mention deeply offensive, they should be told that that's what they've done.
Peter Beinart, senior editor of The New Republic, speaking earlier today with our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. Jack, he's tougher than I would be. Those were shocking events, and to call every emotional response idiocy, I don't know, is it fair?
Well, it's probably not fair, but certainly the ones he cites there and the ones in their poll are flagrant.
They're outlandish.
They're outlandish. There's no question about it. But in many of them, we had to cut this out of the interview. In many of these and in others in the poll, there was a kernel of something. And the speaker was, however hopelessly and haplessly, gesturing at some thought.
I hate to shut down voices at a moment like this, but... Okay, Idiocy Watch, there it is. I'm Tom Asprick. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.